Ah, good. There won't be anything up there except for that title slide for a little while, so you have plenty of time to copy it down. Okay. Well, it's been several weeks since the conclusion of the 2016 presidential campaign and the election. And whether you're a fan of politics, most of us aren't, or not, it's been one of the most fascinating campaigns in American history by far, and it's the only national election that has ever been won, the only president ever elected by a non-politician. Never before, well, you could say, well, what about George Washington? He wasn't a politician. Well, he was a general, so at least he had a leg up on that, but he was the first president. But since that time, the United States has never chosen a non-politician as a president. This time, the United States chose a businessman, and it was surprising in many ways for reasons other than that as well. And it was viewed as a total surprise by most of the media experts as well. In fact, virtually none of them, even on some of the most conservative of the media, almost none of them really expected for Donald Trump to win the presidency. And also because he seemingly made every single mistake that a person could make who is running for president, and yet in the end, it didn't affect him at all in terms of how he was effective in presenting his message. And it's also surprising from many other angles as well. And what I'm saying today may spark some other thoughts in your mind. There's no way I could possibly cover all of the interesting aspects of this election. So if I don't cover things that you have thought about, then there's just no way you could do it. And also, I want to make this disclaimer and this clarification. I'm probably going to say some things that you will disagree with today. And you can do that silently, preferably. But I'll say some things that may seem to be shocking to you or that you've not heard before, or maybe you have heard them before and maybe you have thought of them, but maybe some of you are going to disagree with some of the assertions or assumptions that I make. And I'm going to tell you right now that that is completely fine. That is completely okay, because this is the no judgment area here, no judgment room, and hopefully you'll allow me that same latitude as well, that you won't be judging some of the things that I'll say. I'm not going to say anything outrageous, but there are certain things that we as a church have heard for much of our lives that I may challenge some of you on this, okay? And I hope that you'll allow me that latitude, and I hope that, you know, if nothing else, you may disagree with me, but hopefully it will stimulate your thinking, not only academically and intellectually, and also theologically as well. So one of the surprising angles goes back to the founding of our country and the determination of the founding fathers of the United States to allow and preserve the freedom of speech and to ensure the freedom of the press. And that has been a very, very surprising angle in a slightly different way. And I'll also mention something I mentioned in the chat several weeks ago when this topic was brought up, is that I think that many Americans may have viewed this election as a matter of religious freedom and their expression of religious freedom. That wasn't something that was very well covered in the press, but I believe that it played a part. But the media has become a very, very powerful and influential instrument in the political realm. And that is one of the things that we have seen throughout this election process and many others prior to this time. And the media has always been powerful from the time of the inception of the United States. So you can go back and do research into political campaigns even after the time of Washington and the intrigue and how things played out and how the press played a part after we won our independence. While we were in the fight to win our independence, you had the press that was helping this 13 colonies as it started to form their own voice and to reject the establishment of England and to reject the king. And then it seems like all of a sudden, once we won our independence and then we had people running for president, and then you had all this intrigue and sometimes scandal and all kinds of things happening. But the press and the power of the press has been magnified by the power of technology. We can't deny that, can we? You wouldn't deny that. You wouldn't disagree with me on that one. And how quickly information can be transmitted to virtually the entire population overnight. Although if you watch any of the man on the street interviews, you realize how ignorant some people are. And I'm wondering if they don't just pick the dumbest of the dumb people to ask who the president of the United States is. I don't know. You know, I mean, it's classic when they ask some of these questions of the man on the street. But that aside, as a humorous point, many studies have shown that up to 85 to 90% of the entire media and the writers and the people that control the process of the dissemination of information, that is, whose responsibility it is to report the facts, also have a very liberal bias and a liberal agenda. In other words, not only do they report sometimes the facts, but they also portray them in such a light as though they would like to have them expressed, so that they are not only reporting facts, but they're also hoping to influence opinion. And I believe that this year and several other times in our history, many Americans picked up on that bias and rejected that because they're just sick and tired of the elite of society, those that control that media, and those who are politicians telling them what they should think and should do in their lives. Because, after all, we've always been a pretty independent bunch as Americans. And we don't like people telling us what to do. And I think that's kind of human nature, but I think it's totally embedded in our DNA as a nation that we want the freedom of thought and expression, and we don't want always people to tell us what to do. And when it becomes so overt and so biased, we really reject that. So let me ask you this question. What, if any, are the prophetic implications of the United States presidential election? And does it matter at all? Because I've heard lots of different opinions expressed to me within my 50 years, close to 50 years in the Church of God. Well, it really doesn't matter who's going to get elected because blah, 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 blah. And then they come out with some reasons. It really doesn't matter. But should it hold our concern at all as Christians? Should the results of it, should it be something that we are concerned about at all? Now, let me get back briefly here to the power of the media. It was probably, and it's probably not a surprise, but candidate Trump was correct. It is a rigged system. And it is a rigged system. And talking about the rigged system in media or politics or the corruption in Washington, it is very clearly a rigged system. And it's designed to keep certain groups of people in power. But especially on the media side, one of the things that I find extremely humorous, and this goes back to the early part of this century when Rush Limbaugh played a montage of things that were expressed about the choosing of Dick Cheney as the vice president running mate of George H.W. Bush, 43, let's call him. But when that choice was made, someone, I don't know who these people are, but somebody made the talking point that that Dick Cheney represented, I don't have this in my notes, so I'm going to have to search for the right word. Thank you, Stephen. Yes. Dick Cheney represented a gravitas choice. And so Rush Limbaugh played about 15 or 25 different media outlet talking points and talking heads, as they are called, and they all use the word gravitas. Well, Dick Cheney brings a certain gravitas to the ticket, and Dick Cheney represents the gravitas of the Republican Party. And just over and over again, you hear it in these different voices, and it's so funny that Sean Hannity does the same thing, that they use this montage of talking points that they've all got, and they all go with it. They all run with it. And it's very funny to hear it. And they all come to the same conclusions, even a montage put together shortly before the election that, and even after the election, the funny thing is, after he's been declared the winner, to hear like 20 or so different people say, it will be a Clinton landslide. Donald Trump does not have a chance. Looks like a Clinton landslide this time. Looks like a landslide. Looks like a landslide, political landslide for Hillary Clinton. She should win 350 at least electoral votes. So it was all so funny. And all of that is done, by the way, not just as an expression of their own thought and belief and their own projections, but as a means of trying to suppress the vote somewhere and make people think, well, there's no use even voting for him because she's got it locked up, which is one of the things that she may face in her future, being locked up. So let's take a look at the election results and some of the controversy that has even arisen as a result of the election that has taken place, and that is electoral vote versus popular vote. And I'll get to that. But here's a map. The red states are the states that went in favor of Donald Trump, and the blue states are the ones that went in favor of Hillary Clinton. In other words, red, those are the ones that Republicans won, as opposed to blue. And so you can notice that on the left-hand side of the screen, also very liberal states of California, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington all went for Hillary Clinton, with our neighbors, our very liberal neighbors to the east and to the north also going that way. But surprisingly, all of the states in which was thought that Donald Trump didn't have a chance, which were Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, all of those were thought to be key states, and none of the political pundits felt that Donald Trump could win many of them or any of them. As a matter of fact. And it was close, to be honest. Most of those states were close. You just have to realize the facts. But they all did tumble, and that's what gave him the election. Now, electoral versus the popular vote. Michigan, I think it was yesterday, announced the final results. Donald Trump won Michigan by over 10,000 votes. And so he wins the state and the 16 electoral votes. And that gives him a final tally when all of this is going to be challenged in the courts. Minnesota, various other states are going to be challenged by the Green Party candidate, Jill Stein, who's amassed enough money to challenge that. And they'll continue to try to challenge it probably even after the time that Donald Trump is inaugurated as president. They'll try to challenge the process and whether the – now, they didn't believe in a rigged system. They didn't believe that results could be manipulated, but now they're all in. Yeah, the votes, it's all corrupt. So anyway, that's the election, but most media outlets that I checked yesterday report that about 2 million popular votes for Hillary Clinton than for Donald Trump. So then because of that, as happened in the 2000 race, Bush versus Gore, a lot of people then on the other side of the political spectrum were calling for the Electoral College needs to be abolished. We need to go to the popular vote. You know, so it always works out whenever that candidate wins, the other side says, let's get rid of the Electoral College. But no one was calling for the abolishment of the Electoral College under Barack Obama. But he did, in all fairness, win both electoral and popular vote because of a lot of different reasons, which I won't get into. There's not enough time. But here are the states. This map represents how different states allow people to vote. The states that are in white And many of those are ones that represented states which carried a huge popular vote for candidate Hillary Clinton. All of those states, and there's a lot of them, basically the entire Northeast and the far West, except for Washington, all of them have very, what we would call, liberal voting laws. That means for all of those in the white states, you can basically roll up to the polling place and you do not need identification to walk in and register a vote. That's a lot of states, and some of those are the most populous of states in the Northeast and in the far West. So, well, even in our state, which the dark blue, Arizona, is representative, it has more of a strict voter identification. You don't need a photo ID to roll up to the polling place in Arizona. You can take a utility bill with your name on it. So I'm not sure if there is any manipulation or fraud or stealing of bills or anything like that, and I'm not asserting that, but it just shows the difference. But many of the states that were close and many that were won in the last few elections have very liberal voting laws. And so I'm not sure if this happened or not, and I'm not going to say publicly that it did. But here are the states that don't require any voter ID. Those are all the ones in white that I showed you. And so some news outlets, not a lot, let's be fair, but some news outlets feel that upwards of 3 million votes were legally cast because they were cast by individuals who are not citizens of the United States. And that's kind of a law. It's a federal law that each state interprets. But in order to legally vote in a U.S. election, you need to be a citizen, either a natural-born citizen or a naturalized citizen of the United States, in order for your vote to count, to be legal. That is something that has escaped a lot of people. So we can't necessarily prove it, and there's no reason to prove it now for at least the Republican side. But if you take away 3 million votes who may have been cast by illegal aliens or non-citizens, we would suspect, or most people would suspect, that the majority of those votes would have gone to the Democrat side or Hillary Clinton. So that might negate any popular vote victory that someone could claim. I'm not saying it is, and it really doesn't matter because the law is the law. And the United States operates on a system that everybody knows about. It's called the Electoral College, and there was a reason that our founding fathers did that. They decided that all states should have a say. And even some of those insignificant states with three or four votes would be influential at times to make a determination, and that they would have an important part in the selection of the president. So one question that people have always asked in the Church of God, and now let's say the churches of God, and this is where some of you may just slightly disagree with me, and I'm not trying to change your opinion if you do. And you may not agree, and we can talk about it in the chat, but when we turn to this scripture in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17, and I'll read it because that's what we do, and this was, you know, the 600s B.C., obviously, or 500s B.C., when Daniel and his friends are, and all the rest of Judah is captive in Babylon. This matter is by the decree of the watchers and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he will and sets over it the basest of men. Now, in that sense, sometimes in our history in the Church of God, this one scripture has been extrapolated as a principle that governs all world leaders. But is it? really a governing principle that is always operational, or is this a statement of this particular time? Because let's think about it. Daniel was inspired during the time of Nebuchadnezzar the Great. Nebuchadnezzar the Great was a vicious, horrible tyrant, just like Fidel Castro was, but even worse than that, a vicious tyrant who was responsible for the murderous deaths of thousands of his own countrymen. And this individual was even worse than Castro was. He was not a great man, except if greatness is counted in the sense of being a despot and being a ruiner of men's lives. Because Fidel Castro, I'm glad he's dead, frankly. I'm glad that he died finally. I mean, he lived a long time. You know, Billy Joel wrote the song, Only the Good Die Young, and this guy was evil. He died, he lived a long, long, wretched, miserable, horrible life in which he imprisoned thousands of his own countrymen and killed many more. And he overcame a despot that was democratically elected in the late 50s and became an unelected tyrant for many, many years. And the country is as backwards as can possibly be. But let us examine whether or not this is a universal principle or whether this applies singularly to this particular time and maybe to other times. Because I've heard this passage used by God's people to explain that God puts every single leader in control of all governments everywhere. Now, to extrapolate, that's what that particular line of reasoning is. And in some cases, it does appear to be the case. It was true during the time of Babylon that God actually placed this bad, evil man and gave it to the basest of men. And he worked with that man, and eventually this Nebuchadnezzar had some kind of repentance, as we find throughout the chapters, and he was punished for 7 years and became like the animal he was. And then he kind of snapped out of it, and, you know, he died later on. But you can read through Daniel to find that. But God was working with him and through him to allow his servants to have their part and to set us an example in many, many ways, as we know. So in the book of Exodus, in chapter 9 and verse 16, it certainly seems as though God allowed the Pharaoh during the time of Egypt, who is another horrible, tyrannical, wretched, evil, what other bad word can I use to describe him? Despot and tyrannical ruler. He allowed him to be in charge. And in very deed, for this cause have I raised you up, for to show in you my power, that my name may be declared throughout all the earth, in reference to the Pharaoh. And there's another time in history, in Isaiah chapter 45. Thus the Lord said to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held, to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. Now this prophecy was given 150 years prior to the event. It was given to Isaiah in the 800s BC, and then it came to fulfillment, and this particular act is recorded. This Cyrus, who is named within the womb before he was born, this prophecy came to pass in 2 Chronicles chapter 36 and verse 23. Thus said Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth has, and I've skipped over the part where they invaded Babylon and yada, 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 and fulfilled that prophecy of going in through the river, the Euphrates River, and so on and so forth for another time. But this Cyrus was used by God to execute his purpose to release the Jews from captivity, to allow them to go back to their homeland if they wanted to, and to travel from Persia back to Judah and to rebuild the temple. All the kingdoms of the earth has the Lord God given me. So of the Persian Empire, this Cyrus was in charge, and he has charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is there among you of all his people? The Lord his God be with him, and let him go up. So in these three instances, it certainly seems as though God is in charge of those particular leaders being in power or allowing them to be in power at the particular time, directly involved, allowance, however you want to put it. But does it mean that it is a universal principle? Did God, in fact, choose Barack Obama to be our previous president, or President Bush to be the president before that for two terms, or for Bill Clinton the two terms prior to that, his father, 41, to be the president before that? You may have your ideas about that, and I have my ideas about that, and I would direct you to the book of Hosea, which says this, and this is a prophecy of Israel. Hosea 8 and verse 3, Israel has rejected the good. Israel has rejected the good. The enemy will pursue him. They have set up kings, but not by me. They have made princes, and I knew it not. Of their silver and their gold have they made them idols, that they may be cut off. So you can disagree, and we can disagree on this. This is not a point of salvation, all right? That the statement made in Daniel 4:17 is not a universal statement to be extrapolated and applied to every single leader the world has ever seen, because even in this instance, it seems as though there are times in which God allows nations to choose their own leaders. And I think God is magnificent enough, powerful enough to know what is in the hearts of men and what they will do and how it will turn out. But I think there's a lot of things that he leaves up to us as well. Just like, and this may sound shocking to some of you, that a number of years ago when ministers got together and formed the United Church of God, at the time I had the deep conviction that God was giving us a chance as a church to preserve the doctrines that we had always embraced and believed in, the Sabbath, the holy days, the law of God. But I believe that he gave us the opportunity to figure out, because I do not believe that there is any human government that God has so ordained as more righteous than the other, because by the fact that we are humans, we're just never going to fulfill those expectations. We can look for Jesus Christ as a king to institute a perfect government for human beings in the world tomorrow, but it is impossible for human beings in this day and age, in this age of man, to direct a government that is going to be the only one that will have God's blessing. So I don't believe that God places every single member on our council. I believe that we ministers make choices, and I believe sometimes we've made some bad choices as ministers collectively. Otherwise, all those choices would remain and they'd be here today, and they're clearly not. But God gives us a mind, his spirit, to think, direct, and act. And just like every one of us in everyday actions in life, we don't always get it right, do we? Do you want to? Do you want to do the right thing all the time? Sure you do. Even you, Joe, you do. Pick on Joe Dornick. We shouldn't do that. Anyway, but we all would like that to be the case, but it's not. And so, you know, people have a problem with us voting in the church. And to me, I don't endorse anybody voting for this or that or for political office, but it's not a tenet of the church that you cannot vote, or to vote is a sin. Because you have to evaluate everything that we make as rules and regulations that, you know, if I were to tell you it's a sin to vote in your county, national, state election, I would have to apply the same standards to myself as an elector in the United Church of God. I would have to say, all right, and I've even said this, that I'm okay for our council to just put every name in a hat and draw out 12 and just let the chips fall where they may. I would go for that because I believe in the process of the people. I wouldn't necessarily think that that was choosing lots, or, you know, that everyone would be divinely pulled out of the hat in the right order or anything like that. But I believe that God has given us opportunities in life. And so in ancient Israel, it's clear that sometimes God allowed kings to reign, and God wasn't involved in the selection process because sometimes Israel set aside the good, and or its leaders rejected the good. And Isaiah 3:16 and Isaiah 9 some indicate in some ways, I don't have those scriptures up, but in some ways indicate that there are times when our leaders lead us astray because of their activities and their example. They sometimes lead people astray. So now, what is a Christian's mindset, or what should it be, no matter what the government? The Bible is very, very clear on what you should do regardless of the governmental system that you live in. And there are a number of different passages, but this is one, and we'll cover a few others. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 1 through 2. I exhort, therefore, that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men. And we should do that. For kings, for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. So apparently the Apostle Paul was able to see that even in the despicable Roman Empire, that there was law, rule, order, and that some of those things are blessings for people. So for kings, we can pray for our leaders, regardless of whether they acknowledge God in their lives or not. And so that's what Christians ought to do. And that's what I would encourage you to do as a Christian. That's what I would encourage myself to do, that no matter who is in power, no matter what country you live, that you could utter this particular prayer, and that you would pray for deliverance if you needed it from the powers that would limit your ability to practice your faith. Romans 13 is another one. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. So God allows all of these principalities, these powers. He even allowed the process of the powers to be in Judea during the time of Christ's life. Is that better for everybody or worse, sir? I'm not sure if it is, or if it is, then good. Jesus Christ allowed the power of Pontius Pilate. He allowed Pontius Pilate to have Jesus Christ tried so that he could be crucified. And even though we could, you know, was that an evil act to allow all this to happen, or to have that happen? Yes, it was. There is absolutely no doubt about it. But he allowed, in his sovereign power, he allowed someone to put him to death in an illegal trial for the benefit of all of us. But that doesn't mean that it was a good thing. It just accomplished God's will, and we know that. So what about us, the United States? The United States and our government for the past 200 or so years, which I hope that you did have the opportunity this Thanksgiving Day to reflect and to wonder about and to think about the many manifold blessings that we have had as a nation. We had a very special couple of guests, Paul and Jackie Smith, who are members of the San Diego congregation, and they came over, spent a couple of nights, and they were there for Thanksgiving. And I asked Paul to prepare a little speech to our 20 guests that were assembled as to why we are able as a nation to have all of the wonderful blessings that we do have and that we do enjoy. And it was a beautiful speech. He took his time with it. talked about the freedom of religion that we have that allows us and enables us to express our life in the way that we feel is best, that gives us opportunities to create, and it gives us opportunities to worship God. And it all goes back to God in the end, that God has allowed us to live in this land. And did God create a national day of Thanksgiving? No, men did. Abraham Lincoln, in his expression of his religion, captured a sentiment that was already present in the American people and designated Thanksgiving Day, which goes all the way back to the Pilgrims, as we know, designated as a national holiday. And it's, I have to admit that it's even kind of funny. I had to run out and get some supplies, and I felt, didn't really feel this way, but can you imagine, can you just go with me to this particular place? I almost felt bad about going to Walmart and getting a few supplies that we needed to make sure that everything was going to be right. But it wasn't breaking the law. I mean, Walmart decided to be open, and it had everything that I needed in one place. And but, you know, I did feel like bad a little bit, but then I thought, you know, this is what the American life is all about. We can have these things. And it did make the Thanksgiving Day a little bit more enjoyable, and it took about 30 minutes to get it all accomplished and to check out. And it was nice. So, but we do have a great reverence. Many people do have a great reverence for this national holiday, and I hope that they do take some time. I hope you took some time to reflect, as only God's people can do, on the magnitude of what God has allowed us in this nation. In the preamble to the Constitution, it says, "We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." I don't think anyone doubts that the men who crafted that document, principal among them, Jefferson, and then Hamilton, and the Federalist Papers that he wrote that expressed the feeling of liberty and the pursuit of happiness and the freedoms that this nation would have, for the first time in human history, and the only time really in human history, although the English are not far behind with the Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, and all that sort of thing. But one of the greatest Thanksgivings, in fact, I ever had as a young person was actually my freshman year at Ambassador College. Not since we've been married, honey, because they have been the best. But up until that time, one of the better ones was the invitation to an English home where they invited three or four students over in many of the homes in Brickett Wood, the church members, and they had a Thanksgiving dinner. All the traditional stuff that we would have, the turkey and cranberry and the stuffing and all that. It was great. It was a wonderful time. And they acknowledged that. And I guess over a couple hundred years, you can patch up differences, right, as nations. So, but this is the preamble of the Constitution. It was a government of the people. And Abraham Lincoln said, in the last line of the Gettysburg Address, you know, in 1864, on the battlefield of Gettysburg, the shortest and most memorable speech ever given in the history of mankind. It took about 3 minutes to deliver the whole thing. But in the last line, he says that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Which I think describes our present condition and describes what has happened in our presidential election. So, you may choose to agree or disagree. No judgment from me, obviously. I'm not trying to mind control anybody. You shouldn't really base all your thoughts on mine for any reason, but I believe God allowed the formation of the United States and its human government, and I think you could even say that he blessed its formation, but he allowed men to make decisions. Now, these men, although there has been a lot of argument through the decades by historians, these men, I believe, were motivated by God, because the first thing that many people back in that day read was the Bible. And the Bible had a profound influence on their thinking of civil rights. And even though it took a civil war for us to get to the point to where we abolished slavery, and even though slavery was a part of this nation from its beginning, which was horrible, a horrible condition, it was a product of the times. The English were the first to abolish slavery, the slave trade. Many other nations kept it up. The United States, I think, was the second to abolish slavery. But the aspects of slavery remained far, far longer than any of us would have hoped. And it's been a horrible blight on the human condition. No one would argue with that. And Washington himself, one of the founding fathers and our first president, released upon his death, freed all of his slaves from Mount Vernon. Now, there were some that were controlled by the estate of his wife that she had inherited, and, you know, theirs argued over that. But he was one of the first to release all of those servants from slavery and give them freedom. And it, of course, was something that continued on. But we know also, through many of our studies, we believe and we know that the formation of the United States is actually a nation which is an extension of ancient Israel, and has had delivered to it from that time of our founding the manifold blessings that were originally promised to Abraham and to his descendants, and on through Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph, and who carry the name Jacob. And certainly we realize, and we come to acknowledge it in a public national way every Thanksgiving, all of these blessings, and people do acknowledge it, whether they know that it came from Abraham originally or that it came from God given to Abraham and his descendants, they realize God is a part of the process, and they understand it. And we had great minds who had studied the Bible and had read the Bible, and the Bible is the only document and was the only document in history that provided for the individual freedom. And Israel was a nation that had those individual freedoms. That was guaranteed by the law of God, and then it was crafted into our own human law. And in that way, I believe it was inspired of God, because the inspiration has to come from somewhere. And if that was their influence in studying the Bible, which it was, then that's where its inspiration was. It wasn't as though, you know, I'm not saying it's though God was guiding the hand of Thomas Jefferson as he was writing out in longhand the Declaration of Independence. No, I'm not saying that. But because of their studied approach to understanding what the law and the Ten Commandments provided, it found its way into document. And for the first time in history, a government was crafted that was designed to serve the people and not the other way around. Because in every other government, it is the people who serve it. Now, what I believe happened in our most recent national election is that people woke up to the fact that they have been in contradiction to that original founding, that they have been serving the government rather than the government serving them. So God allowed the people to choose their leaders. Sometimes we don't always make great choices. I don't believe that God chooses our presidents as much as he allows our presidents to serve. We the people do, and by that I don't mean you necessarily, but we the people do. And again, that's an opinion that I have. And it's also my opinion that as a nation, that's okay with God, if you want to put it that way. He allows us to choose our leaders. So we come back to, I want to visit this briefly once again, the Electoral College versus the popular vote. As I mentioned before, the drafters of the Constitution knew that some states would be smaller, some would be larger and more influential, so they designed a system that would award state votes according to the size of the population of that state. But as we have seen in many elections, some of those smaller states can play a pivotal role in the overall results. So they or their specific interests cannot be ignored by the leaders. But let's take the other side of the argument that it should be done by a popular vote. And if that were the case, then the campaigning of each candidate would change because the rules would be different. They would adjust to meet that requirement rather than the electoral vote. And, you know, up until the last day prior to the election, Donald Trump was in like four or five states, the critical states, giving speeches, rallies, having in huge, I mean, the guy, if you disagree with virtually everything else, you can't say he's lazy. And he did it at his own expense for the most part, although they raised money towards the end of the last year. But anyway, you remember the electoral map. Many of those states would be irrelevant to politicians because they would definitely be flyover country. They would be of little concern. So now that it's done, how did the president-elect win and why? And does it have any prophetic implications, if any? Well, again, you know, you're getting some opinion here today, right? You know that. I believe that this election was a repudiation of the liberal and socialist agenda of not only our previous president, Barack Obama, which was definitely socialist and had a socialist agenda, but it's also added to the socialist creep in our government for the past 60 years, ever since FDR, and maybe people could go back further than that, because he was the first one to institute some of these widespread programs, social programs, that eventually they can't help but fail, like the Ponzi scheme called Social Security. Well, I'm going to start collecting in a few years, so I better stop calling it a Ponzi scheme. But anyway, it's something that is designed, and it's going to be a hard system to continue to prop up for a lot of reasons. I'm not going to go into that right now. But since And that repudiation that took place hasn't been just this one time. It's been going on for a number of elections since 2012. And some of this information may shock you, so it's not my opinion. It's just a matter of fact, researchable facts. Since 2012, the majority of state houses, that is, there are some states that have two legislative bodies, and some only have one. But since 2012, the majority of state houses and governorships have gone to the more conservative party. 68 of 98 state legislative houses are in the Republican majority now, and there are 34 Republican governors out of 50. And for the first time in many, many years, the conservative party is in charge of both the legislative branches federally and the executive branch of the U.S. federal government. These results tell us that it's a repudiation of liberal media bias, which has had the audacity to tell people what to think, how to act, whom to choose as their leaders. It's almost as if, remember going back, we the people, it's almost as if we the people said, enough. Not we the people, but we the people of the United States said, enough is enough. I see parallels between two other dynamic elections, 1968, won by President Nixon, 1980, won by Ronald Reagan. Some of the same parallels are there. In 1968, the country was in a turmoil over the Vietnam War. There were demonstrations. We had a problem with lawlessness. Richard Nixon won largely based on his campaign of law and order and respect for life. That was one of the hallmarks of President Reagan's campaign, his anti-abortion stance. And just like that particular election, they had it too close to call for many, many days. And actually, it broke out into a landslide victory for Ronald Reagan. And then the next one is even more so. I think Mondale in 1984 carried one state, Minnesota. This wasn't as resounding a victory, perhaps, but the country is, at least many people in the country, have moved a lot left of center than a lot of other people. So I think if there is anything that may have been an unmeasured factor that hasn't been talked about, it was during the last debate in which many of the pundits thought Donald Trump did horribly and that Hillary Clinton easily won that. But there was one thing that he said that you may remember if you watched those. And if you didn't, then I can't really blame you. But it was kind of a tough, tough campaign. But in talking about the late-term abortions, Donald Trump said, "It's wrong. It's just wrong." He didn't go on to elaborate a lot, but that particular statement, I think, won him a lot of votes from the conservative right. It's just a wrong policy. One of the other hallmarks that we saw was the respect for the work of first responders like the police. Not once in his presidency, now, this is where I'm not really going to be concerned about political correctness at all, by the way, just so you know. And I'm not choosing sides. I'm just stating a fact. But not once during his presidency did Barack Obama come down in favor of the average policeman on the street or for law and order. They used the legal system to manipulate, to stir up problems, to stir up difficulties. And I believe people do follow their leaders, and you give rise to an anti-police sentiment. And guess what? It's no surprise if those police sometimes are killed by people who have been given the initiative because you as a leader haven't stood up for them. And I believe that with all my being, that had he done anything to shore up the respect for law and order, then the presidency of our new president probably wouldn't have happened because, you know, by and large, people would have gone with the respect for the law that was shown. The election was also, I believe, a repudiation of the Clinton machine, which, since Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas, has been filled. Their lives have been filled with intrigue, scandal, the promotion of lawlessness, as well as the utilization of public office for the accumulation and aggrandizement of vast personal wealth. I mean, when somebody accumulates $250 million from next to nothing, I think they've made a lot of money. There's too much to document all of those potential problems and scandals, but I don't think that that was lost on the people that did vote Donald Trump. So, what is possible for the years ahead, or even decades ahead? I'm not prognosticating, but I'm just laying a groundwork. We'll finish it up here in just a bit, of what is possible. Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 43 says, "The alien who is among you shall rise higher and higher above you, and you shall come down lower and lower. He shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail." The problem of illegal immigration may be, caution may be implied in this passage, as well as even legal immigration with the birth rates of people who are not descendants of the Europeans gaining more and more and having more and more as time goes on, not to be racial, but the white component of our population gets less and less and so on and so forth. So it's possible that this may be implied in this passage of one of the blessing and cursing chapters. Leviticus 26 is the other. And if it is, if this is a hint towards people from other countries gaining dominance within the American scene or in the Anglo-British scene in any of the countries of the descendants of Israel. One of the campaign promises of Donald Trump is to stop the flow of illegal immigration and even begin the deportation process for those illegal aliens who are criminals, which has the media and the liberals up in arms. How dare he want to deport criminals? I mean, by extension, how dare he want to get rid of these illegal aliens who have committed horrid crimes in our country? They should be given the same due process of law. Oh, come on, get out of town. So if the campaign promises are held to, then our immigration laws will be respected, which actually we don't restrict legal immigration. We just want to put some limits on it. And at times in our history, there's been no immigration in the United States. We've made the statement as a nation, okay, we've had enough. We've had enough of people coming from overseas into our nation. And of course, they assimilated into a melting pot and assumed all those American values and believed the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, and believed it as if they were here in 1776. But there are some who don't. And they come into this country and they don't embrace those same values. So you see the difference. I can't remember the time period in which it was mentioned, but over 700,000 crimes in the state of Texas alone committed by individuals who entered the country illegal, many of them violent, many of them murders, as a matter of fact. So people would say, well, wait a minute, politicians don't keep their promises. Oh, yeah? Barack Obama kept his promises. He kept his promises. He did very well in keeping his promises. He accomplished virtually everything that he set out to do in addition to his Unaffordable Care Act that was passed. It's called the Affordable Care Act. People call it Obamacare. President Obama did a great deal. He accomplished a great deal. Much of it was bad. Much of it was horrible for our country. The Affordable Care Act has been a complete disaster, and one of the things that President Trump has promised to do is to repeal and replace a failed system because it is going downhill. You can't afford it. I mean, I look at the premiums that some people have to pay, and it is crazy. And to make it a law that you have to do it is totally un-American. So President Obama, let's be respectful, was able to get through and do a lot that he wanted to do. So you can't tell me that politicians can't get things done. And now Donald Trump has much more political power and capital than President Obama did. He does. He has more support from the states. He doesn't have as much support maybe from the electoral map or popular vote, but he has more political capital than any other conservative president has ever had in modern history, going all the way back to the 1920s. He's got both houses of Congress. He'll be able to nominate who he wants for the Supreme Court, and our country would have been changed incredibly so had that not been the case. So you'd never know that, by the way, if you pay too much attention to the media, because now the struggle will begin, and that's a whole different story and ballgame, because now virtually everything is going to be opposed, and everything he even talks about or suggests is going to be a horrible, wretched, rotten idea, and or it's going to be thought that way by you millennials. Are there any of you here? Dare you raise your hands? It was the most amazing thing. Kind of funny in a way to see the caterwauling and the crying and the whining of how horrible life is and the threats to commit suicide and leave the country and all this kind of thing by millennials. Donald Trump has promised to make America great again and put America first. The failing of the last 60 years of any American president has been the entanglement in foreign wars. The Middle East wars of the last 20 years have added greatly to our national debt, and we've really not changed any hearts, minds, attitudes, or anything else by what has happened. It was a noble thought, but our national debt now stands at $19 trillion. President Truman got in sideways with Korea. That's why he was a one-term president. Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, all embroiled in Vietnam. Bush 41, Bush 43 in the Middle East. All of these are wars that we haven't won or had no victor. And George Washington, in his farewell address, said something profound. I'd always thought that he had said to avoid foreign entanglements, but he never made those statement in his farewell address in just after he left office. It is our true policy to steer clear. This is just one part of a 34-page letter that he wrote in his own hand. It is our true policy to steer clear of permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world. So far, I mean, as we are now at liberty to do it. For let me not be understood as capable of patronizing infidelity to existing engagements. That is, if we have treaties with other nations, we ought to respect them. I hold the maxim no less applicable to public than to private affairs, that honesty is always the best policy. I repeat it. Therefore, let those engagements be observed in their genuine sense. But in my opinion, it is unnecessary and would be unwise to extend them. Almost prophetic in nature. So let us assume that President Trump will be able to avoid unnecessary foreign entanglements and first to defeat ISIS, as he has said he would do, and prevent their spread upon our own country. And then the other promises, which you've heard, to fix the economy, jobs, regulations, shrink government, build the wall, drain the swamp, repatriate trillions to American businesses, fair trade. I'm not looking at any of these in a caustic or critical way, because I believe he could accomplish all of them. I believe it is possible. Now, whether he will be able to, or whether it will be done, or whether there will be unforeseen circumstances, we don't know any of that. But I believe that he has the will and the power to be able to do that. Do you realize that we now, and I didn't think that this could be possible a few years ago, that we now as a nation could enter into an economic boom that would rival any that we have ever seen in this country? It is entirely possible for the country. As I reported last year in a sermon, we became the world's largest producer of oil. When in 1974 they said, we're running out. We're going to run out in 10 years. Just like they said, we're all going to be like the Arctic winter for all year long. And then it changed to now we're all going to be drowning in the melting of the polar ice caps, which is not going to happen either. But I digress. In energy, I mentioned that we became the largest producer of oil, eclipsing Russia last year. And they just discovered, apart from all of that, they discovered another large find in the Permian Basin of West Texas of 900 billion barrels, not gallons, barrels of oil. That's a lot of oil. That'll fuel the nation for a long time. So along with the utilization of coal and natural gas and shale oil, which seems to be everywhere, it's in Pennsylvania, it's in New York, it's in Ohio, it's in places they never thought they'd have that much oil. In a nation that's already wealthy, a great economic recovery is possible. Now, will this all happen? I don't know. And what are the ramifications if it is? There are spiritual ramifications. I'm not just preaching, you know, everything is going to be rosy and nice, but I'm concerned about myself, my family, all of us, as a matter of fact, if that happens. Now, if the bad stuff happens, we've been prepared for that for decades because that's what we've all been told and thought. But what happens if things are prosperous? Matthew 24 and verse 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. There's never any letting up on the pedal for spiritual development for the people of God or the practice of our Christianity. No matter how great things become, we're still Christians first. Our allegiance is to God and to his kingdom, and we're citizens of this nation by birth, but we are citizens of another nation. We are individuals who are in a different kingdom altogether. in essence, our requirements as Christians never change, whether in good times or in bad. We're always to be vigilant, always to be obedient. There's no taking time off as a Christian. So if we do have a time of peace and prosperity, I'd like you to take note as we close of some of the amazing things that Solomon mentions in the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 12. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all of his labor. It is the gift of God. So whether good times, bad times ensue or in the future or in the offing, we really can't predict, and I don't really know. But I will say that based on the last 8 years, I know that policy changes can make a huge impact on a nation and can have a lot to do with to steer the nation's thinking and to stir some segments of the population. So good can do that as well. Righteousness can do that, and I'm not calling any political leader righteous because not one is good, right? So in Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 18, Solomon was inspired to say, here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all of his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and has given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and to rejoice in his labor, that is the gift of God. And we should always remember that in good times. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. When a nation is prosperous, it is a blessing from God. It is totally a blessing, and we can enjoy it, and we can have fun, and we can still be obedient to God in doing so. And then finally, in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9, it says, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun. You know, our life is temporary. Whether Christ returns in our lifetime or not, our life is temporary. All your days of temporary life, for that is your portion in life, and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Do it with the ability that God has given you. Do it as if your life depended on it, for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. And we all know that we're headed there at some time as time goes on and if time goes on. As far as exactly what the future may hold, none of us can really predict at all. The church has always pointed to the return of Jesus Christ and the establishment of the kingdom of God. But while we cannot know the time of his return, we have been given clear instruction as his servants as to how we must conduct ourselves.